This is Robert Stark. I am joined here today with The Truth Will Live. Nice having you on.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me. I feel honored.
So just to give some basically background information is I discovered you since you're basically Luke Ford's co-host. You and him do a Torah talk show, and basically the show is I guess part of the show is about the Jewish religion, but it's also he also talks a lot about politics and race, and he also likes to flirt with you. So it's a combination of those three things.
Yeah, we basically started doing this because we thought it would be interesting to sort of relate like modern day issues to biblical texts. Because, or from a Jewish perspective, because I don't really see a lot of people doing this, and there's a lot of relevance there.
Was it his idea originally, or was it your idea to do that?
Well, I wanted to do like a YouTube thing, kind of like I'm actually a fan of your podcast. I listened to it. I've listened to quite a few of the episodes, so I kind of wanted to like be the new you, but on YouTube,
so you've been,
like
did you discover me via Luke Ford, or you've been following me before the show was linked?
You know, I don't think it was through Luke Ford. I think it was just through because I'm pretty interested in a lot of alt-right stuff in general, so I think it just came up. Because you've interviewed quite a few people. So I think it was, I don't think Luke told me about it. I think I just found it on my own. But, yeah, so I wanted to do kind of like what you do, but a web or a YouTube series where I talk to people about issues because, I don't know, it's kind of needed. I like hearing people talk about these things and there's not that many people doing it. So I interviewed Luke first because I had been talking to him before, just corresponding about things. And then I did one interview with him, and then he had this idea that we could do a Torah talk show together. He had been doing it a few years ago, but he had stopped. And then I thought it sounded like a great idea.
I think he did one a while back with, it was a couple years ago with this Orthodox guy with a long beard. That's the one.
Yeah, it was like Rabbi Rabs.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah. But I think he had stopped doing it for a few years, but he decided now would be a good time to revive it.
I heard your new show got you a marriage proposal.
Yeah, I don't want to talk about that because the person who proposed to me heard Luke saying that on the show and got really, really mad at me for telling him.
Okay.
So I promised him I wouldn't discuss it ever again.
So you don't agree 100% with everything that Luke says?
What?
No.
I think I don't agree with everything that Luke says, and I think that's what makes our show kind of interesting because I don't think either of us are particularly moderate at all. That's not really our forte, being moderate, but He goes to extreme lengths sometimes, like calling for deporting all sorts of people and things that I don't think will ever happen and probably wouldn't be the right path to happen.
Sometimes,
like,
you know, sometimes Luke reminds me of, have you seen that Seinfeld episode where Jerry's dentist converts to Judaism purely for the jokes?
You know, I haven't seen that, but someone asked me if he converted just so he could say inflammatory things about Jews and not be held accountable for it. Someone brought that up. They thought that that's why he converted. Sometimes I think they're right. He just wants to get out of jail free pass, but
I was wondering about that. So I mean, so I'm 1/16th Jewish. Do I get to say that kind of stuff?
Yeah, but I don't know. I actually think if you're Jewish, because then you're like gonna get criticized from all, even more people. I think.
And you get,
like,
you would
Jews,
get totally.
Yeah.
Socially ostracized. Like, for example, especially, like, if you go to, like, say, a Reform synagogue and you talk about the type of stuff Luke talks about, you would be totally socially ostracized by all the people there.
I would think you would be socially ostracized at any synagogue in general, or any church, for that matter. He apparently, he says that the more Orthodox you go, the less people care about that type of thing. I wouldn't know. I'm not super experienced with that kind of thing, but that's what he's claiming, is that he's gotten better responses in Orthodox communities. But yeah, if you were to go to a Reform synagogue and say that, you would absolutely be socially ostracized.
Yeah, he's saying they don't care as much. Orthodox Judaism doesn't care as much about all those type of issues like feminism, gay rights, and amnesty for illegal immigrants.
Yeah, because their moral code is different than the modern moral code. Whereas like Reform has basically, you know, moved with the times. Whereas Orthodox people don't update their moral code. They have a strict moral code that doesn't change, and it does condemn gays, and it says that men and women aren't the same and have different roles. So they are more open to that sort of thing.
I remember on your show you were telling a story. There was this Reform rabbi she's a feminist. And she was saying she actually didn't like the Torah because of its views on women, but she basically views it more as like the diary of her people.
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting, and it's kind of I don't really know how you would reconcile any. I mean, there's things that it says in there that are crazy, that, you know, kill all heretics, and I mean, it doesn't say that directly kill all heretics, but it says some pretty outlandish things. And I guess Reform people just think of everything as some sort of metaphor, but they don't really, I don't know exactly what moral lessons they take from it. I think because they're on this universalist streak the same way as everyone else is, so I think they find a way to take those stories and apply it to whatever it is they believe in the first place. So it's kind of like they're doing it backwards. Like they're taking what they already believe and then applying that to this book and trying to reconcile it. I have no idea how that works. I don't see how you could, but tons of people do it, so must work out.
What religious denomination did you grow up by?
I grew up conservative, which is like basically in between Reform and Orthodox. But yeah, it was quite a bit more intensive than what Reform people do. But I don't know. I don't really remember. Even though I had to go to Hebrew school like twice a week and then temple like twice a week, so this was like four times a week that I had to go, I didn't really learn anything. It was more just like be hanging out. Maybe that's just me because I didn't care and I was just wanting to socialize or something. But yeah,
I find it spiritually fulfilling.
Yeah, no, I really didn't because. They don't really teach you about living a certain way or following moral code. It's just kind of like, okay, like give charity and be a good person. But they don't talk about, like, with Orthodox, they really emphasize like there's a huge emphasis on male nature and female nature and how those are like a complementary thing, whereas I don't remember talking about that at all. I don't remember really, it's like for people who don't want to restrict their lives in any way, they just kind of want the social aspect and some sort of vague spiritual lesson, but there's no restriction on how you actually live. Like, you can keep kosher, and don't really know anyone who did, apart from the rabbi. And it's egalitarian, too, so there's no separate roles for men and women, like there are female rabbis. But actually, what's interesting is the temple that I went to was kind of, like, behind the times, and they didn't let women put on the tefillin, which is, like, the prayer box. And I thought that was, when I was younger, I was like, that's horrible. We should all be able to do the same thing. Because it was, you know. So it's kind of like in between Reform and Orthodox, but I would say closer to Reform. It's just kind of like for people who want to have a community and pretend like they're learning something, but it's Orthodox Jews will say that it has nothing to do with actual Judaism, and it's like a heresy. So,
so you're interested in converting to Orthodox Judaism, but you're not 100% sure about it.
Yeah, you know, I'm really attracted to that lifestyle, and I've spent some time like hanging around Orthodox people, and I think it seems like if you're gonna have kids, it seems like a better way to raise them because there's a moral standard, whereas in mainstream society it's considered sort of oppressive to like hold people to a set standard, bigoted or whatever. And it's interesting, it's like if you don't have a religion to justify it, you're not allowed to say like, you know, it's wrong to have sex before marriage or, you know, like dress like a tranny or do anything like that. It's like you have to have some religion to justify it. You can't just be like ultra conservative and not religious. It's like all or nothing.
So yeah, you're saying you can either like be really religious and have to follow all these strict rules or be out in the streets marching for gay marriage.
Gay rights.
And and
that's
immigration
amnesty. Yeah, that's what Luke is always saying, is that we live in this world of extremes where there's not really a lot of places for someone who's like doesn't want to follow this strict code of conduct but generally agrees with what those people are doing. It's like you either agree with them and join them and do it, or you're like against them. Like people like Reform and conservative Jews think Orthodox people are crazy. And they think that they're really oppressive towards women, and they just think they're nuts, for the most part. I mean, maybe not all of them, but I think most of them think that they're just totally superstitious and, you know, just want to have every part of their life controlled. But interestingly enough, I know, like, a lot of people that I grew up with, like, became Orthodox, like, a long time ago, and I don't even know how to really get in contact with them because they just kind of disappeared like years ago, and they're like, I don't know, but apparently they became Orthodox, and I'm assuming they have like 10 kids already and, you know, live that. But it's like people, when they do that, they kind of usually just disappear off the face of the planet. But I know like quite a few people that went that path. I think it was kind of interesting.
Are there any aspects about Orthodox Judaism that do not appeal to you or that make you hesitant to join that community?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot. Like, you can't eat at restaurants unless they're kosher restaurants. So that is incredibly restrictive. And I don't know, I love eating at restaurants. So I think that would be really hard for me.
Luke and I, we set up this event in Beverly Hills, And I don't know if you heard about it. It was at a place called the Gem Center where Tom Sinek was a speaker. And like, I wanted to go to like a nice restaurant in Beverly Hills, but we couldn't eat anywhere. So like, we had to eat at Starbucks.
Yeah, I mean, that's just, and Luke will say that the reason for that is to keep, to make sure Jews are in the Torah choral. I think you've probably discussed this concept with him. That, so there's like minimal contact with non-Jews. I think he said that's the reason for that. But like, if I wasn't able to eat, if I was only able to eat strict kosher food, I wouldn't even be able to eat like at my family's house for holidays or just for anything. And that is just, you know, I don't want to do that. So that's pretty, I think that's a pretty big deal. And what else? I don't know. I'm not the most spiritual person either. I mean, I believe in God, but I'm not necessarily always inclined to pray. I don't know, though. Maybe I don't know how.
As far as your values, are you more looking for something that No, you're saying not necessarily looking for something that's spiritually fulfilling, but you're more interested in the culture and a community.
You know, I am looking for some sort of spiritual fulfillment, too. I think, like, if you're living for something that's bigger than yourself and you feel like you're a part of something, I think that can be really fulfilling, like believing in God in that way. But, yeah, there's a few reasons. Like what you said. And I don't know, I've heard a lot of other people going through the same thing. A big reason they go down that route is because they see so much immorality in the world and they are, I think, overwhelmed by it. And they feel that they need strict rules and a strict absolute morality that doesn't change. Because
have you thought about like creating your own sect of Judaism that like combines like that without the aspects of Orthodox Judaism that you're hesitant to accept, with also like the type of let's say like the maybe with like the neo-reactionary politics like combined like,
yeah,
but also maybe aspects of you say Mormon and Seventh Day Adventist cuisine as well.
Yeah, I that's another thing that me and Luke talked about is that the unhealthy diet of a lot of Orthodox Jews, it's like very fattening, and I don't know, they're not treating their bodies well, and maybe that doesn't need to be a part of religion. Maybe you could just educate people about nutrition, but I really like
yeah,
how,
so you agree about the diet's unhealthy, you just didn't like his solution to the obesity problem.
No, that was too far. That's an example of him going way too far. To the point where I know I'm laughing, but I shouldn't be. I'm just, you know, I always laugh at that type of thing, but I really shouldn't because it's inappropriate. But I don't know, maybe diet doesn't need to be a part of religion, but I think it's important to have a healthy body as well as soul, otherwise you're not going to feel good. I think that's like a big part of being spiritual for me, at least. So yeah, I mean, that would be really cool if I could create my own sect. I don't know how many people I could attract. I'd probably not get that many people to join. Maybe, but I don't know, I think I also tend to think that, you know, maybe the community that I want or the people that would agree with me do exist out there, because there's so many people, you know, and there's so many different sects, like in Israel and in New York, so I don't know, I might not have to go that far, I might just have to find the right people that maybe already agree with me on everything, or maybe not, maybe I would have to create my own sect.
And the other thing is I guess you also, so you went through a phase where you were an atheist.
Yeah, I did. I think it was because I had all this religious stuff thrown at me forever, and I didn't really like it. I just thought it was pointless and a waste of time. So I got into atheism, but some people when they're atheists, they don't really, that's where it ends. They're just, okay, I'm atheist. But I was one of those people that made atheism into like my religion. Like I would be on forums with other atheists talking about atheism and reading Richard Dawkins and watching videos about atheism. And then at some point I just realized there wasn't much to say because you're united in what you don't believe and it's pretty empty. And it's not very fulfilling either. I'd say it's pretty nihilistic and it didn't really last very long. I think I was only like 18 at that point. But yeah, I pretty much became like agnostic after I went through that phase.
You have these interesting videos. So you talk about how your views changed. So originally you were basically a leftist and a feminist, and you had a number of different life experiences that changed your views. One of them was this discussion you had over women in math. I know there's another experience you had when you had a friend who was like this kind of stereotypical, like, guilt-ridden white liberal, and you had this experience in Baltimore. You had those two experiences.
Mm-hmm. I had a lot of experiences like that where just my worldview, I encountered facts and I had experiences that kind of contradicted what I had thought to be true. And I also think that the fact that I was liberal to begin with isn't necessarily because I was sold on leftism or any of those issues. It was just because that's kind of the default in our culture is liberalism, because you associate conservatives with people who, like aren't smart. So it's like you have to go through this maturation process to kind of get rid of your liberal conditioning, because that's kind of how everyone starts, I think. I mean, some people
the other thing is censorship. Originally, being liberal is being observations of censorship. I think one of the points you made was about the CEO of Mozilla being fired for opposing gay marriage. And you also brought up how that group blocked Jared Taylor to speak at a university.
Yeah, I mean, I've never been into, I used to be really into punk rock, and I guess I still kind of am, but I kind of compared that type of censorship to like the Tipper Gore, PRMC type of censorship that happened with music in the 80s. And even though the message was different, I didn't think that anyone should be censored. I was probably more of like a classical liberal type than I ever really was a leftist. But I thought classical liberalism was more, I think I was mostly just uninformed about what leftists believe. And as soon as I realized what they believed, I was out of there. And it didn't really last very long.
And on the issues with dealings with your views, like towards race and gender issues, how did those issues change? How did those views change?
Well, I think I read something by like Jim Goad, and he was talking about, he wrote this article that made a huge impact on me. It was called Racism, the Eighth Deadly Sin. And it was just about how all of these other horrible things that people do are kind of swept aside, whereas if you're racist, it's the worst possible thing you can be. And he said the reason for that was just to push equality on everyone. But I don't know. I thought that was, I just kind of realized that maybe, you know, having an opinion about another race isn't this horrible sin. And it just seemed like there was so much emphasis on this is the worst thing that you can be as a racist, or the worst thing you can be is politically incorrect. Whereas there's not really much attention paid to whether you're a good person or not, or whether you treat people respectfully. And I think a good example of that is, like when I was in punk or whatever, I played with a band with the singer had killed his girlfriend like 20 years ago. And no one would protest that band, but they would protest, like, you know, a band that they thought was maybe slightly racist. And I just thought that there wasn't a lot of coherence in that kind of, I don't know if that can be called moral relativity, but I just thought it was overblown that people thought that racism being a racist is the worst thing you can be. It's worse than being a murderer. It's worse than being a rapist. And that's kind of what Jim Goad kind of made me realize that, because he writes about that a lot. And the other thing that he brought up in that article is inherent racial equality. And I actually sent him an email about that when I read it. And he told me about, he said that I should read Nicholas Wade's book that he wrote. This wasn't even that long ago. That book only came out like less than a year ago, I think. But so I read the book and it was pretty convincing. But honestly, by the time I had thought about it, it just made sense. What are the chances that every race or every group is going to be exactly the same? It just doesn't really make sense. If you believe in evolution, then you will believe that different races evolved differently in their environments. And I don't think that's particularly groundbreaking, even. But it's just, if you mention that, you just get called a Nazi or racist, and people will go to amazing lengths to deny that it's true, but all the evidence points to the fact that it's true. And it was just interesting to me, because it was like I had to go to these dark corners and depths of the internet and the library to actually find the truth. And once I had found that truth, the truth about race and gender, it was like I wanted to keep going and find the truth about everything. And because I just thought, well, what else have I been lied to about, or what else did I learn in school that was incorrect? Because, I had actually been assigned to read Guns, Germs, and Steel. I don't know if you're familiar with that book.
I haven't read it, but I know the basic idea where Jared Diamond says that basically Europeans conquered other groups because of guns, germs, and steel, not because of that they were inherently more intelligent.
Right. And basically he says everything is due to their environmental resources and the fact that they had domesticable plants available to them. And so I had been assigned to read that book in college. And I remember that when I was kind of getting interested in all this stuff about racial differences. So I went on Amazon and looked up like the negative reviews of this book to see what other people had to say. And it was just filled with people saying, yeah, Jared Diamond's a liar and this is propaganda. And my first instinct was to be mad that I had been forced to read like a propaganda piece in college, because I just thought that was wrong. But it goes a lot further than that. But yeah, that was how I got interested in that. And from there, it was just one thing after the other, basically, in terms of everything in society that I had taken for granted to be a good thing.
How did your views change on gender issues, gender roles?
Well, I read a Camille Paglia book that called Sexual Persona, and that was really influential on the way I thought about gender and men and women, because she has this infamous line in it that says, if women had been in charge of society, we would still be living in grass huts. And I kind of thought that was, like, ridiculous at the time, but it made me question everything I had learned about feminism. And the other thing was that I was kind of starting to fall out of feminism to begin with, because they didn't acknowledge racial differences, which actually is huge for women. Because I don't know if you saw that catcalling video that was a big deal.
Yeah, I did.
6 months ago. And I don't know, like, white guys don't really catcall ever. I mean, maybe once in a blue moon. And I just thought that was absurd that feminists wouldn't acknowledge that. It's like they want to be equal opportunity haters. So then I kind of realized I don't think they really care about women in general. And
I'll give you one example. In Sweden, which is the most, Sweden is like the most feminist country, but they're also letting in like all these Muslim immigrants who obviously would have the worst record on that.
And it was just stuff like that. As soon as I realized that they didn't really care about women, it was more they care about sticking to their narrative, you know, the same as any other leftist. And I guess it's only been in the past few months that I've become more radically anti-feminist. Like, I actually don't think men and women should be treated the same in society, because it results in dysgenic effects on society. Because if you push all your women, your intelligent, capable women into being CEOs and chasing their careers, eventually, you know, they're probably not going to have children. Eventually, your society is going to decline.
You get
like
the film Idiocracy.
Yeah, exactly. And this is the problem, the reason why I'm so kind of taken with neo-reaction and that, you know, dark enlightenment, is because they're more willing to look at the health of society as a whole and the long-term goals of society, which is kind of like an anti-enlightenment attitude, because with the enlightenment, everyone was so focused on the individual and the happiness of an individual and individuals' rights, whereas this is kind of radical in that it's more focused on society at large. So I think that's really interesting. And I think the health of your society at large is amazingly relevant to the happiness of an individual, because we're not, you know, people, we're not free-floating islands unto ourselves, which is kind of what a lot of libertarians...
They have this concept that's called non-aggression. Unless you directly attack someone or steal from someone, you can basically do whatever you want.
Right. But it's just, you know, we're social animals, and I think people need some sort of sense of community or some sort of sense that they're part of something bigger than themselves to really thrive, because otherwise you get a bunch of lonely people in apartments just trying to do separate things, and it doesn't really make for a healthy society.
What do you think about, there's this concept of a sort of in-group versus out-group identity? So, there's a question is, the type of people who are going to be listening to this probably would say, we favor in-group identity. So if you have a strong in-group identity, it's basically, it's all about your people, and it doesn't matter whether the other groups, basically they can live or die, and it doesn't matter. That's one extreme. And I'll give you an example of that. Like Luke was saying in one of your shows, like he doesn't care about, he could care less what happens to, say, Muslims or what happens, say, happens to Africans. And then the other extreme is people with a strong out-group identity. And I guess an example of that would be there's Christian groups who are very, they're very universalist, and they go around the world doing a lot of, say, charity in places like Africa. And those are two different extremes. Do you believe having a strong in-group identity is the ideal, or do you think there should be some kind of a balance? I think your sister was kind of making that point in the first show you did. Like she was saying she thinks there can be a balance where you have a little bit of both. What do you think?
I think I would agree with her that there should be a little bit of balance. I think that if you only care about your in-group at the expense of everyone else in the entire world, everyone in the entire world is probably going to hate you. And I think you need to sort of, I don't know. Well, have you ever heard of this thing called like the white man's burden?
Yeah, I have. Yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of like, I don't necessarily agree with the way church groups go and give people an after. I don't know. I mean, I'm sure some of them are doing things right, but I don't think it's like beneficial to pretend that everyone is the same. I think that actually hurts people more. I think, like, I know people that advocate that we should go back to colonialism because that's the humane thing to do, is take over these African countries instead of letting them be brutalized by dictators. But then I know other people that say, well, no, because look at what happened last time. It just completely backfired. So, you know, I'm not really sure. This is something I've thought about a lot, but I can't ever decide if the attempts to do good for the out group will backfire or not. I tend to think that they won't, and that you should try to, you know, heal the world as much as you can. But there have been times when people, I think, were trying to do the right thing and it kind of backfired on them. There's this thing called, there's a concept called pathological altruism. People are so focused on not themselves that it will be at the expense of themselves. So they're so focused on helping other people that they will destroy themselves in the process. So I think there has to be some sort of balance so you don't get that.
And I guess the other example of those two extremes, there's some people who advocate like complete racial separation where basically one side, one extreme advocates complete racial separation, and then the other side advocates complete like unlimited immigration and complete mixing between groups. Do you think those are basically two polar extremes, but do you see there as being a middle ground between those two?
Yeah, I mean, like Jared Taylor says that we should just have freedom of association. So people who want to segregate themselves should be able to segregate themselves. People who want to mix should mix. And that's the end of it. I don't know how that would be put into place. And there's been other people that have said, well, it's never going to work because can you imagine like this thriving society next to this really dysfunctional one? What's going to happen? They might just say, well, you oppressed us to get this, or they think that that would just lead to more problems. But
I know you and your sister got into a debate with your aunt. This was at Passover over the issue of freedom of association versus discrimination.
Oh, yeah. Let's see. I'm trying to remember exactly what we were talking about. Yeah, you know, we were basically arguing, saying that people should be able to have freedom of association. And I think the only argument that other people had was that that sounded extreme. It's always an ad hominem that your argument sounds extreme, but no one can ever think of a reason why it's actually a bad idea. But the interesting thing about that is, in regards to segregation, like in schools and stuff, like I've heard leftists sort of coming around to this idea that, you know, black kids should have black teachers and black role models, and they should have their own schools and their own places. So it's kind of interesting that they have that, but I always going in cycles, like, you know, segregation yesterday, integration today, segregation tomorrow, and then we're going to do integration again. It's like no one can ever make up their mind about what they want. What they want is for everyone to be equal, but no one will, the outcomes will never be equal. But I don't know, it's just, I think, you know, blacks have their historic universities where it's only black, and whites aren't really allowed to have that. And it seems hypocritical. The leftists will tell you that it's because whites are the majority, or they have white privilege or something. I don't know what they'll say. But I think as whites become a minority, which is going to happen, I think people might start realizing that how much of a double standard that is. And I also think as the demographics change, people are going to start waking up to all of these things that Luke is saying, or coming around to that. Or maybe they won't. Maybe they'll just fade away. I don't really think so, though. I think there's going to be some problems in the next 50 years.
So what's interesting about you is both you and Luke, also Luke Ford, who you do your show with, have an interest in both Jewish issues and European and white issues. There's generally a perception that both of those groups are in conflict because, first of all, I mean, most white nationalists tend to dislike Jews. And then on the other hand, basically every major Jewish organization like the ADL and the Simon Wiesenthal Center is in favor of mass immigration.
Right. What I have to say about that is there are a few fringe Jewish organizations. Luke never wants to acknowledge this, but I'm going to acknowledge it because I think people should know about it. There are some like fringe Jewish organizations that don't support mass immigration and amnesty and talk about anti-white racism. I think that would be like the JDL in Europe or the JTF, or it used to be the JDL here too, but it was banned. But those, you know, those types of organizations are a lot more honest, but kind of get overlooked because, you know, people just want to keep to their narratives. But yeah, there is a lot of, you know, there's a perception that, yeah, most white nationalists hate Jews, and it's correct. I wouldn't necessarily call myself a white nationalist, but I don't know. I see all the crazy anti-white rhetoric in the media and people I know, and it just, there's something in me that just says that, you know, that's not right, and if I speak out on that, what, I'm a traitor to Jewish people? I don't see how that's necessarily in conflict, because first of all, non-whites are going to see Jews as white, and Jews are also affected by anti-white policies like affirmative action, and I think there's this tendency for people who are people who are white nationalists to think that Jews have some sort of magical force field that, like, protects us from, you know, black crime or types of issues or school integration or, you know, property values or mass immigration. But
a lot of people see it purely as a Jewish issue. I see it especially as a class issue. So people with money, regardless mm-hmm. of whether they're Jewish or Gentile, are going to be able to separate themselves from those
right.
problems.
Right. See, I don't know. It's like I have a lot of firsthand experience with those problems because, you know, I come from a fairly middle-class family, but we had, like, school integration at my school. There's another guy who blogs about race issues. It's, like, jewamongyou.wordpress.
Yeah, I've interviewed him a really long time ago.
Yeah. And he was, like, bussed into the inner city. So he has some experience with that. Alana Mercer is another person who writes about, I think you did an interview with her too, writes about South Africa. And I actually have some relatives that are from South Africa that agree with me on all of these things. And I don't know, maybe I'm deluded in that I think if more Jews are outspoken about this, maybe they can lose this sort of reputation. Maybe I'm deluded. I think Luke thinks I'm deluded that I'm going to change anyone's mind, but I guess I don't see the harm in trying, even if people are going to call me a Nazi or a kike or whatever. I feel like it's, I don't know, like when I listen to Jared Taylor talking about never before in history has the majority population been replaced and just been expected to like cheer it on or accept it without any sort of backlash. And I think he's completely right about that. There's not really an argument against that, because if that was happening in China or Korea or any of these other places, you know, it would not be seen as acceptable. So
I mean, it's something that is, it's really a terrible thing, and if you speak out about it, you're basically demonized as a bad person. But the other thing is, like, the mainstream conservatives won't talk about it. Like, if you listen to mainstream conservatives, they'll talk
right.
about issues like radical Islam, or they'll talk about illegal immigration, but they won't
yeah.
say that it's a bad thing for Europeans to be dispossessed as a people.
Right. Yeah, most people in general will not discuss this. But if you point it out, they don't really have much to say about it. It's just such a taboo to talk about this. But what's interesting is that it's not seen as taboo for other races to have solidarity. It's like white, and I actually was just talking to a black friend about this. He said that it's ironic that white nationalists want to be more tribal, because whites are kind of the only group of people that has this universalist thing, and that's kind of a white thing in general. So in effect, if they want to be more tribal, they're kind of becoming less white, but at the same time asserting their white identity. But I just think that, you know, and maybe it is too late and the country is just going to go to shit, but I guess I just want to be, I feel like this compulsion to tell the truth, even if it's going to, you know, make people not like me. And I don't see, you know, if there are white nationalists that hate me because I'm Jewish, I understand that they always will, and that's fine, but I think that...
Have you interacted with those white nationalist sites that much or no?
Yeah, I have, like, I've had people attacking me on Twitter and stuff, and I kind of, you know, I like, read, you know, Radix Journal and stuff like that, but I kind of had to, like, stop reading the comment section because it was just, like, so much anti-Semitic stuff, and I kind of stopped reading it because I was just like, this isn't... But it also, at the same time, it feels relevant to me because I grew up in this, like, multicultural America, and I see all this anti-white rhetoric, and it is directed at me. Like, leftist whites would absolutely consider me white, and non-whites would absolutely consider me white. The only people that wouldn't are white nationalists. Some of them would, but most of them wouldn't. I just think that's interesting. It's and Luke says that it's because Jews won't, for the most part, associate themselves with, or won't say that they are, just, you know, because then they get more of a victimization status. But I don't know. I don't see the good in painting yourself as a victim either. I don't see what good can come out of that. I don't think that's a noble pursuit to paint yourself as some sort of victim, especially if it's not true.
You were talking about a comment by a fellow YouTuber, and he was pondering the question is about whether all these people who get into that kind of dissident, dark enlightenment and neo-reactionary politics, are they just broken people, and is the world, is society just fine, and these are broken people who are blaming their own personal failings on society?
You know, this is another thing I've thought a lot about, but I don't know. I don't think I'm, like, necessarily a broken person in general. You know, I've made mistakes in my life, but I do, at the same time, realize those were my mistakes. And the reason I gravitated towards those movements wasn't because it was, like, obscure or because I wanted to, you know, like, be some sort of special snowflake. It was just because it was the only people I could find that were being or are being completely honest, like brutally honest. And that's something I really value is honesty. So, yeah, I've talked about this with a lot of people that, you know, maybe people are just using this to justify their failings. And, you know, yeah, it does seem to attract some broken people. But at the same time, I can't think of that many points that they've made that aren't true, you know? And it also, a lot of the points that they make are just rehashing lost wisdom or lost knowledge that, you know, we have forgotten. And it's kind of...
broken people can, they basically have nothing to lose. People who have a status, they're not...
Yeah.
Being, in a sense, embracing the ideology of the establishment is a way to have high social status, so people who have a lot to lose want to keep that social status.
Right. Yeah, and it's not, you know, I'm not a person that's, like, has nothing to lose. I just can't live a lie, you know? I feel, like, inclined to be totally honest about everything. Because if not, then you're deluding yourself or you're deluding, you know, whatever. And it's interesting because, like, sometimes I will get so wrapped up in dark enlightenment and all of these things that I'll forget that you can't be honest in the real world with everyone. Because if you do, they'll look at you like you're crazy. But I'm still convinced that, you know, these people have really latched on to something true and everlasting or something real. It just feels, I just haven't found anything that they've said that hasn't been truthful for the most part.
So we are getting towards the end of the show. I would definitely like to have you back on soon in the future. I think a good topic for our next show, if you'd like to come back on, would be the sort of cultural and aesthetic decline in our society.
Yeah, I would love to talk about that.
And this leads to the next topic, but I'm really interested in this because, like, I'm in the arts myself, and people who are interested in sort of arts and culture, that's sort of stereotypically associated with the left. So
yes,
for our next show, we can talk about that.
Yeah, I would love to. And yeah, I mean, do you have this problem where you feel like a black sheep in a way? Because you don't, I don't know, I don't really fit the archetype of a of a conservative, or what people think to be a conservative person. And I've also heard people describe like neo-reaction and the Dark Enlightenment as conservatism, like for hipsters or for stuff white people like types, which I thought was funny because it's kind of true. But yeah. I was going to say, it seems like there are a lot of people who are, I mean, most of the people involved are writers or artists of some type, or, and most of them, I'm not sure exactly, but a lot of them seem like they're ex-liberals, and a lot of them were like very, very left, like communists. So maybe it's like going from one extreme to the other. And I do, it is possible that I have an extreme personality, and I want to be extreme, but so many, yeah, it's possible that's the case.
So, The Truth Will Live, it's been an excellent show.
Thank you. I had a really nice time, too.
Thanks again for being on. That's all we have for today's show. Take care, and we'll be back with you next time.
Great. Thanks. Bye.